Hi, and welcome to the Princeton Pulse podcast. I'm Heather Howard, professor at Princeton University and former New Jersey Commissioner of Health and Senior Services. On campus and beyond, I've dedicated my career to advancing public health. That's why I'm excited to host this podcast and shine a light on the valuable connections between health research and policy. Our show will bring together scholars, policymakers, and other leaders to discuss today's most pressing health policy issues, domestically and globally. We'll highlight novel research at Princeton, along with partnerships aimed at improving public health and reducing health disparities. I hope you'll listen in as we put our fingers on the pulse and examine the power and possibilities of evidence-informed health policy. Job burnout affects every industry, but none as profoundly as healthcare. Up to 54% of nurses, physicians, and other clinicians experience prolonged occupational stress. They suffer exhaustion, low job satisfaction, lack of achievement, and other consequences that not only compromise their personal well-being, but also the care they provide to their patients. That's why clinician burnout is a concerning public health issue and the topic of today's episode. Our discussion spotlights the drivers of clinician burnout along with the rising costs. We'll look at absenteeism, high turnover, and other repercussions that have led to staffing shortages and that ultimately threaten access to quality healthcare in the U.S. and beyond. Most importantly, we'll brainstorm strategies for reducing clinician burnout through a systemic approach that leverages actionable data. Here with me in the studio is Dr. Bryant Adebe, Sugarman Practitioner in Residence at Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Dr. Adebe has done extensive research on this topic and put together a summit here at Princeton. This first-of-its-kind event is uniting thought leaders with various backgrounds, including scholars, healthcare providers, and policymakers, to advance the collective pursuit of clinical well-being. Also joining us is Dr. Wayne Jonas, a practicing family physician and researcher in the areas of pain, stress, and human performance. Dr. Jonas is president of the Healing Works Foundation, which is co-sponsoring the Systems Summit on Clinical Well-Being. Dr. Adebe, Dr. Jonas, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So let me start. Dr. Adebe, it's been such a pleasure having you in community here at Princeton as a practitioner in residence working on the problem of physician burnout. Can you tell us how you came to this issue?
Yeah, no. Again, thanks for having us. And, you know, this is something that I think has been near and dear to my heart for a while. You know, I in medical school, I had a dear friend who was a mentor and was several years ahead and was someone who encouraged me quite a bit. And he, I learned, you know, suffered from a tragic suicide. And that was really the first time that for me, I began to look into this issue of kind of who's caring for the caretaker and this problem of physician well-being. I started my career as a chief wellness officer at a small college in Los Angeles where, you know, really came face-to-face with a lot of issues around food insecurity and other challenges, and then later moved on to a similar role in Chicago. And I think it was in Chicago where I really got to see the breadth of what we're facing with physician suicide, mental health, as well as burnout, turnover, and impacts on organizations at the system level.
You worked at a big hospital system, right?
So I was at Rush University System for Health in Chicago, you know, close to 20,000 employees. It's a big place right in the heart of the city, serving, you know, west side of Chicago, south side of Chicago, and everything in between.
And you were chief wellness officer?
I was, yeah.
Were you the inaugural or?
I was, yeah, which, you know, look, I started there at the end of 2018, you know, before the pandemic started. And, you know, we had no idea what was up ahead and how important having a wellness office would be in healthcare.
Wow. Now, Dr. Jonas, you're a family physician, but you've got this really interesting background, diverse background in practice and research. You were at the NIH, WHO, but now at the Healing Works Foundation. Can you tell us about what you're doing there and what brought you to this issue?
Yes. Well, thank you for having me, and it's great to be here. Before all those things you just mentioned, I was in the military as a military physician for 20 years. And I still see patients in the military, see a lot of veterans. And talk about resilience and talk about burnout and talk about PTSD and the things that actually healthcare workers are faced with now because they're on the front lines, literally fighting the battle of disease. We saw a lot of this in the military, and I still see a lot of it. It's not a matter of stress. It's not a matter of too much work. It's really a matter about of whether you're in a situation when you can actually accomplish what you're there to do. And I think the big challenge that we have right now in the area of burnout, and it's not simply burnout, by the way. You didn't mention one little statistic, which is 20% of healthcare workers have left during the pandemic. And so we have a huge shortage. So it's not simply getting people that, you know, really aren't up to snuff to do their job. It is there aren't people there. Okay. There's a huge shortage, and it's going to grow, actually, as more physicians retire and have left, mm-hmm. and as nursing shortage, everybody is familiar. So you won't even be able to get basic health care. The challenge here is not so much about burnout, in my opinion, which is a consequence of not actually having a system that supports the well-being and the ability of healthcare providers to do their job. They're mopping things up constantly because we have a system that's designed to actually wait until disease occurs, and then we got to throw a lot of stuff at it. And that stuff is usually very expensive and very profitable for certain ones. But, you know, clinicians see what's coming down the pike. They see how these things could be prevented, and they see what needs to be provided in order to not only to prevent that, but actually reverse many of those conditions. A lot of it's out of their control, but they're at the tip of the spear, and so they see it every day. And this, I think, is the fundamental underlying problem. So I've been involved in what I call whole person care because I think we have to pay attention to those invisible aspects that are causing that issue. I just described something that I experienced and saw and still see a lot in the military, but it's happening in healthcare. It's called moral injury. That's what just happened, what I just described in these areas. But we also need to make sure that mental health components are key, that we have support for mental health. We don't just shove it aside either by stigma or, you know, other kinds of consequences. And we need the social and emotional support where people can acknowledge that they also need healing when they're facing trauma on a day-to-day basis, which we are.
And is that what your foundation focuses on?
Our foundation focuses on whole person care in order to facilitate healing, salutogenesis, the creation of health, which I think is where healthcare has to focus if we're going to solve this problem.
So Dr. Adebay, Dr. Jonas sort of brought us back to sort of how we define this problem.
Yeah.
And how we name it can really help how you get the attention of policymakers and whether you get their focus. He said, don't talk just about burnout. So how should we talk about it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, I think, you'll hear this issue described from both sides of the same coin, right? On the one hand, it's an issue of burnout. On the other, it's an issue of clinician wellness. Mm-hmm. It actually doesn't really matter, I think, how we from a terminology standpoint phrase it. The important thing is that we recognize that there's a real problem going on in healthcare. This issue isn't something that cropped up during the pandemic. This isn't something, I think, much to many folks' surprise, was obviously worsened by the conditions in the pandemic. But this is something that there's been a well-established body of literature for decades looking at kind of these challenges, including moral injury that Dr. Jonas described. I think at its core, though, it's only till recently that we've really started to understand what's at the root of these problems. You know, when we look at kind of the studies that have been done, we call it kind of like the first chapter in this space, a lot of it focused on quantifying the problem. So how widespread was burnout? The statistic that you quoted earlier is part of that kind of first chapter of this body of literature. In the second chapter, I think we started to think through what are early interventions, right? Where you start to think through mental health support and supporting this that are largely focused on the individual. I think a lot of the work that I have done here and certainly that Wayne was just describing that his foundation has done is this emerging third chapter that we're entering, which is a focus on the system and recognizing that clinician wellness isn't this separate problem, this separate entity, separate from workforce, separate from social support, housing and food security for our patients, separate from the operational realities of a health system. It's actually at the root of it. And in our definition, and the way that I see this problem, a true systems approach to this says, unless if we can provide a system where providers can be at the bedside doing the work that they love, taking care of patients in the right way, they're going to continue to experience the disillusionment. They're going to continue to suffer under the administrative burden that, as Wayne mentioned, is driving them away from our field, which ultimately has a downstream impact on public health.
So you both use the term clinician. Does that mean, Dr. Adebe, this is not just about physicians? I mean, you're both physicians, but can you – what do we know about how broad this problem is?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's broad. You know, so there's evidence that says that even in a clinical team – so for those that may not be oriented, clinician referring to, you know, an individual who is taking care of patients. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physician. It could be a nurse. It could be a respiratory therapist, you know, any member of the healthcare team. There's evidence that suggests that a single member of that team experiencing burnout actually increases the rate and risk of burnout of other members of that team and actually can have a downstream impact on patient quality. So no, this isn't only a physician problem. There's certainly – this is a big issue in nursing. I know this is something that we've talked and thought a lot about as well as in many other disciplines.
So Dr. Jonas, how does it impact quality of care? Can you talk us through sort of how we see that playing out?
Actually, should be pretty obvious to someone who's walked into an office and a person is not listening to them, you know, doesn't know actually what their particular problems and needs are, doesn't talk to them as a person, but is just sort of going through a checklist and throwing out pills and procedures in those areas if they can actually get in to see them. And they have to wait, you know, 6 weeks, you know, to even get into the office. They get 5 minutes. They get interrupted in the first 30 seconds. I mean, these are the attempts to stay on the treadmill that somebody who is not really engaged in taking care of the person but is just trying to deal with the disease in front of them, you know, the disease du jour. And people experience this all the time, and it leads to dissatisfaction. They don't like those kinds of encounters. The clinicians don't like those kind of encounters, by the way. If you ask them what was the most rewarding thing they had in their practice and they look back, it's about relationships. We're going to have a stellar talk by Krasinski from the AMA today on the economic cost of not focusing on the relationships. You can't do that if you're burnt out, okay? You can't open your heart. You can't have empathy. You can't bear compassion. You can't hear what really matters to the patient, and you can't provide the kinds of needs they need in order to get healthy. And so it's pretty obvious to anybody that walks in through it. And people are dissatisfied with that. I mean, the dissatisfaction scores are not with the individuals. It's with, boy, what happened to me right here when I walked in to the system? Mm-hmm. And, you know, then they try to get back in the system and they get a Rolodex phone, you know, push button dial thing, and no call back. And this is because of the shortage and the attempts to shortcut these areas.
Okay, so I hear you on it's disrupting access to care.
Yeah,
it's diminishing quality. Can you quantify safety?
Yes. I mean, safety has been a problem for years, decades, I would say. I mean, there was a landmark study done by the National Academy of Medicine over two decades ago now, maybe 25 years ago, showing that errors, okay, in medicine are somewhere between the third and the seventh cause of death in the United States. Not a disease, but the medical interventions that we get. And some of that was due to burnout, fatigue, et cetera, which we've tried to correct. Some of it is just the complexity of actually delivering healthcare, which requires that you be at the top of your game. And if you're not at the top of your game and you don't have a system that then corrects the usual human errors, it continues on. And I think a recent update on that study indicated that we've made very little progress in that area. Actually, safety still remains a problem despite all these attempts, you know, to correct it within the current system.
So access, quality, safety, then the big one for policymakers is costs, mm-hmm. right? We know already that we've got – that our healthcare system costs more than other wealthy nations and we get worse outcomes for it. What are the cost implications of
– Yeah, I'll take that one. Listen, I think – and just to piggyback on what Dr. Jonas was just sharing, I think another important consideration on the quality safety piece – is really simple. A burned out physician, we know statistically, is more likely to commit errors. It makes sense. Just like a burned out driver on the road, an exhausted driver is going to be more likely to commit traffic errors. And so there are real implications for that, not just for the patients that they serve as the safety kind of measures that he mentioned, but for the health systems, right, and the implications for them, as well as for the families and for the provider themselves. You know, as we think about the guilt and shame and moral injury that they experience, it's really a significant issue. When we look at the problem of cost, that's actually what a lot of kind of my body of work here, Heather, at Princeton has focused on and been about. And Wayne mentioned one of our colleagues, Chris Sinsky, who's done some great work on this. We know that burned out physicians are statistically way more likely to turn over and leave. And so if you leave, let's say in primary care, you lose a primary care physician, you don't just lose and replace that physician, right? A new physician has to establish a new relationship, as Wayne mentioned, and that often leads to unnecessary additional testing, additional costs, imaging, and costs that then translate to the health system. So it's been well documented that burnout leads to higher rates of turnover, which leads to greater healthcare expenditure costs. So this isn't just a problem that impacts the individual health system, what we call little s, but also big S, right? Like there's actually been documentation that this increases costs at the national health level.
And this is happening in nursing as well, right? And we heard during the pandemic, the hospitals needing to rely on traveling nurses. Is that still the case?
You bet. I was actually in the hospital yesterday and a nurse came in that I didn't recognize. And I found out later she was a traveling nurse. And so the supervisor came in and was trying to get her up to snuff on the system and how it was working. So the efficiencies were much less. The costs were higher. They were paying her more than the employed nurses that were there. So it is absolutely a continuing ongoing problem.
You know, we're also seeing across the country, but home here nearby in New Jersey, more labor strife in the healthcare industry. Does that surprise you that this is happening? Do you see that as connected to this issue, Dr. Jonas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, if there's a shortage, then and you can't get people to come in and fill in, that means workload is higher for those that are there. So that's strife right there. When you do bring in, and I'll use your example of the traveling nurse, they're paid at a much higher rate, okay? And so the nurses that are there who see that say, wait a minute, I'm doing the same work, maybe even less, or maybe even more than this person's doing, and that she's getting paid a lot more. I just don't have the flexibility to travel all over the country and do that type of thing. And that causes, some animosity also in those areas. So there's strife from, you know, both the physical burnout and the workload as well as the emotional toll of on the team. To really work well together.
So this is very depressing, but let's shift.
Let me talk a little bit about costs, though, the bigger costs,
Okay, sure. Not
just the cost of burnout, because the cost of burnout is a tip of the iceberg of the overall costs. And you mentioned it, okay? We spend double any other healthcare country in the world, and yet our health is worse and is getting worse. Life expectancy is dropping compared to other countries significantly. So it's not that there's not enough money here, okay? Hey, there's much, in fact, but it's not being focused on the things that would keep us healthy. Okay? It's focused on mopping up the leak while we haven't gone over and repaired it on the floor. We're just hiring more janitors, right, in those areas. And so it requires a redesign and a refocus, not more money. But a focus on the money, on what actually works to create health.
Well, policymakers will like to hear that, right? Because it's always hard when the answer to – when you go to a policymaker and you say we need more money, right? You know, it's hard. So that's – it seems to me a wise approach. So let's dig in there. You mentioned, Dr. Jonas, that 20% of clinicians had left. So is the focus now on getting people to come back in or retaining those we have, sort of even just as a threshold question?
I think one of the talks we have at the conference tomorrow, Eldar Sharif has written a book called Scarcity.
And
he talks about how the mindset of scarcity, the sense that you don't have enough, actually drives you into behaviors that perpetuate the fact that you don't have enough. And I think healthcare is in that situation, right? Now, okay, is that if we think, I can't actually open up a bed, and he gives an example in an operating room that was overloaded, lots of the delays and that type of thing, and his solution was open up a bed and don't use it. make it only for the for the emergencies that come in, and then that will help the other flow. And they were saying, what? We have to use every single bed, et cetera, in these areas. And so that mindset actually mm-hmm. needs to be shifted. It's not a matter of taking resources away. Nobody wants to not have their heart attack stopped if they're in the middle of it, right? We need the emergency care services, but if that's all we're focused on and we're not focusing on preventing those things, then it will be an endless stream of increasing costs and poorer outcomes.
So Dr. Adebay, you mentioned this earlier that while there's really important work to be done working with individual clinicians and supporting mm-hmm. them, but you've shifted your focus now, I think, to thinking about these mm-hmm. systems answers. So what are some suggestions? What are some of the things you're working on?
Yeah. You know, look, I'll start with, I think, just a simple analogy that makes it easy for folks to get. You know, the big question in this space is often improve resiliency, right? So more meditation, more yoga, more mental health support, more resources, right, to address the problem. And what I say is, listen, if every day you go into work, you get hit in the head with a hammer, right? The solution isn't more resilience. The solution is to get
more
rid of the hammer, you know? You get rid of the hammer, right? And so getting rid of the hammer, in my mind, is building a better system, okay? And so for health systems, there's a couple things that we can do. The first is to recognize that this issue of clinician well-being is a truly operational issue. And up until recently, that wasn't clear, I think, to a lot of us, right? And so what that means is if we do not care for the well-being of our workforce, they will leave. Our costs will rise because we'll have to bring in traveling nurses, right? Our patients will leave, or our expenditures will go up to manage the same amount of patients. And so when you think about the healthcare environment that we exist in now, where margins are so razor thin, where costs are rising, where medical inflation, which, by the way, has continued to outpace general inflation for the past two decades, right, continues to be a factor, the true way that we're going to accomplish this is by building a system that allows us to retain the best providers and keeps them at the bedside to take care of our patients.
But does that mean tackling this sort of increasing corporatization of healthcare?
You know, that's a tough one, I got to say, because, you know, the truth of the matter is there, and I not everyone will agree with this, but this is kind of my personal take on it. I think there are advantages to both. And there are certain things that private enterprise and business can do that others can't. You know, we have actually at our summit invited for-profit health systems that are doing great things for the well-being of their providers. And there are nonprofits that may not be. And so, you know, it's a tough question. There has definitely been a rise, as you mentioned, in the space of corporatization, the role of private equity, and it's yet to be determined kind of long term what that looks like. I don't know, though, that in the short term, it has to inherently be negative. I do think we can use private business to solve a lot of the issues that we have.
As you look around the country, do you see systems that are doing this well, that are figuring this out? Or are there, you know, in policy, when I teach my students always, is it's much easier to learn from people who are doing it well rather than to create new ideas out of whole cloth, right? So is anybody doing this well?
Listen, I'll say this. I think there's definitely exemplar systems. I think as a community, and I don't want to speak for any individual health system, I think we're all trying to find kind of what the next step is and operate within these constraints of kind of the policy limitations that that.
But how about the military? Is the military figuring this out better?
The military actually does do it better, mm-hmm. and they've shown that because it focuses on the underlying drivers of health. They need to have people that can perform, right? Not simply not come into the emergency room or the hospital. They need to actually perform, and so they have created systems like Total Force Fitness, for example, that we helped with, that really looks at these underlying drivers of health and human performance. The VA is actually doing an extremely good job. You know, it used to get a bad rap 20 years ago, but it has improved tremendously. Now they provide better mental health than the private sector, for example. We'll get to the private sector in a minute. Mm-hmm. They also have a program where we have representatives at mm-hmm. this conference in called Whole Health, which really focuses on behavior, lifestyle, social and emotional, and what matters to the individual. And they have shown that that lowers costs significantly and improves health and lowers burnout. Increases satisfaction. So there are a number of systems that actually do this much better. Okay, there are also a number of private for-profit systems. So this is not an issue of mm-hmm. the government versus the private sector. ChenMed is an example of that. They look at the poor elderly. And they have a system that saves money and keeps them out of the emergency room and out of the hospital and improved health. The satisfaction in that network, which is largely in the East Coast at this point, is through the roof. The people love it. There's one that was just purchased by Amazon called Iora Healthcare that was doing the same thing. It was a for-profit component. I think there are systems in certain regions of the country, larger systems like Kaiser Permanente, for example, in certain areas, okay, that do an exemplar job and have demonstrated this over and over again, that you can actually improve health for the public and for the population and for everybody that you deal with.
Of course, Kaiser just experienced the largest strike in the country in the history of healthcare workers, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not easy.
And it's not all Kaiser over the entire country, okay? Okay. In the areas where they actually have responsibility for the entire population, like in Northern California, that system performs much differently than one that's in the competition and is just trying to get people and people through the door.
So it's not, if it's not the form of the system, is it, it's the features of the system, it sounds like, right? And is one key, I think I've learned from you over time, is agency, right? Is clinicians having agency. So is that the right way to think about it then?
That's correct. If I can't give what my patient needs because the insurance company will not cover it, even though it's the only thing available to actually help them get better, then I have lost my agency. And that happens all over the country now. And that will create moral injury for me.
So one thing we always try and do in this podcast is make sure we visit the health equity implications of a policy. And how do you see health equity being impacted by clinician well-being? Is it, you know, does it affect certain types of providers more than others? And are there certain communities that are going to be more affected by these access, quality, and safety issues?
Yeah, big time. Listen, I think it's a great question. And one of the things that I know both Dr. Jonas and I talked a lot about as we were developing and designing this system summit on clinical well-being was the importance of incorporating safety net under-resourced institutions as part of this gathering. And actually today is our pre-con event where we're focused exclusively on well-being in those environments. You know, our dear colleague, John Ionian, and a few others of us, we reached out and said, you know, listen, what really does the body of evidence, what does the research say on this topic? We know about burnout at blue chip institutions. We know about well-being at the best and brightest. But what about in institutions where there isn't quite that funding, where, you know, overwhelming amounts of their bottom line each year are supported by public dollars and who are taking care of patients in the lowest socioeconomic levels? And the truth of the matter is there's still a lot that's unknown in that space. There are a few things, though, just from our conversations that we've learned. The kind of providers that practice in these environments are often different. These are often folks who are very much focused on a mission. They're very much focused on a purpose, right? That they're not going into these roles for personal financial gain, right? They recognize that they are going to be treating the most complex patients, often with the least amount of resources. On the patient care side, though, which I think was the other part of your question from equity, you know, these patients often will be disproportionately impacted, right? These are folks who we just last night actually were having a conversation about a patient who, you know, was essentially in liver failure and was struggling at a safety net, under-resourced facility. And they could not get this patient to a facility that actually had a liver transplant program, in part because this patient did not have the right kinds of insurance. Heather, I think that's wrong. I think it is one thing if folks aren't able to be treated because we don't have the means to take care of them, we don't have the capacity, we don't have the skill set. But to sit there and say to a patient or to a family, we can't take that patient transfer. We can't open up that bed because we want to know who is ultimately going to pay this bill. That doesn't feel right to me.
I mean, we're back to the moral injury, right? Of, you know, and if we need to call out if 10% of our country people don't have health insurance, you know, how are we going to have an equitable system? And why should we be surprised after COVID preyed on historic inequities, right? Why should we be surprised that this problem is probably preying on them as well, right? And playing out. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
we can always know more, but we already know enough.
That's a great point. We already know enough.
Okay.
You're in an ivory tower where we always want to know more and we always want to research. But so say more. Why?
We absolutely know what the solutions are to both the equity, the cost, and the health improvement issues. They're all a joint at the hip. So even the best healthcare delivery system only improves health, actual health, by about 20%. That's been documented over and over and over again. That means 80% of what people need in order to stay healthy and be healthy, to flourish, doesn't come from healthcare. Okay, it comes from the fulfilling the other aspects of Maslow's hierarchy, right? Fundamental social support, food, shelter, safety is at the bottom of the hierarchy. Belonging and social and emotional mental health issues are, you know, in the middle. And the aspirational issues, people want to be able to do something meaningful in their life. And that's the spiritual component of that. And Maslow described 70 years ago that this is why people flourish, if you fulfill those needs. But if a child doesn't even have those fundamental food and shelter and safety issues, or if they don't have a loving relationship that actually can prevent adverse experiences, then they are going to get sicker as they go along, and the healthcare system ends up mopping it up and certain groups making money off of that. Okay? So if we want to solve the problem, we will refocus not just the healthcare system, but the social safety net components to those fundamental characteristics that prevent the disease in the first place. And that will hit cost, it will improve equity, and it will improve health in general.
But it's not so easy.
No.
To be able to map it out. And in fact, you've both mentioned this conference that you've organized here at Princeton. Can you talk about what you hope will come out of it and what are some of the lessons and what you're hoping to inspire going forward?
Yeah. Listen, I think we don't hold any illusions that we're going to solve all of healthcare's problems in a conference. What I do think is, listen, we wanted to be really thoughtful about the folks that we invited here to campus, and that included some of the top healthcare organizations in the country. And as I mentioned a moment ago, it also included several safety net under-resourced institutions that could provide another perspective. I think one of my goals for this conference is that, you know, I spent a lot of the last year, Heather, on the road, speaking at hospitals and having these conversations and kind of, you know, talking at these different clinical facilities. And I often found there were two conversations that occurred. There was kind of this public conversation, right, that was very refined and polished and espoused, you know, these kind of corporate values. And then often afterwards, we'd have kind of these dinners or, you know, these conversations where you'd have the healthcare leaders there in a more real environment. And the conversations were more frank and they were more honest and they really revolved around the issues. And as I went from facility to facility, I kept hearing the same things. And that was part of, in my mind, one of the goals for this event was to create a space where we could have those conversations and try to identify what potential solutions could be and how to kind of move in that direction. That would certainly be at least one of my goals.
Yeah. I'm a little bit more modest here.
it's good more he's
modest, but
he's
no,
young.
It's fantastic, right? I think if we could move substantially a step towards identifying the measures and the metrics that our country values, that we are willing to pay for and design policies to actually pay for those things to occur, that involve risk reduction and involve reversal of chronic illness, if we made those up front and then the designs of systems would follow. Mm-hmm. Okay, the workforce would follow, the redesign of the health system would follow, but it has to follow the values and it has to go beyond healthcare. It's why we have a whole day on what we call the big S, the big system, the things outside of healthcare delivery that are driving health or interfering with that. We have a lot of the policies already in place. There is a new report that just came out of the National Academy of Medicine. We have the chair of that committee is going to be here. It's called Valuing America's Health. And it actually lays out a whole set of detailed policy shifts that would take resources and financing right now, whether it's private or public, doesn't matter, and invest it in the things that we know produce health so that we don't have to keep investing in things that don't produce it. And I think if that actually were something that came out of this conference, it would be a huge accomplishment.
So you're really broadening the lens here. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're focusing the lens on what matters, on what actually produces health, okay? You align the value of the investment with the values of what you're trying to accomplish, not just doing more of something and paying somebody for it if it's not actually producing what you're looking for.
Dr. Adebay, if I invited you back here next year for a status check, where do you hope we'll be on this issue?
You know, I think one of the things that I learned, at least during my time in Chicago, is that health systems don't really have the tools that they need to address this issue adequately, particularly at like the little s level, right? So the individual organization. As you know, one of the things that I've been working on here at Princeton is a bit of software called our wellness dashboard that enables, enables health systems to be able to quantify the costs of burnout such that you can understand kind of what this indirect costs impact is on the bottom line. It also helps identify where burnout is occurring, why it is occurring, and it provides recommendations on what they can do about it. And if you go online, you'll find online calculators that can give you these broad things, but this really gives kind of surgical precision for your exact healthcare system. My goal would be that I think tools like this are more widely spread and used, and that healthcare leaders are actually able to move the needle on this issue using resources like this.
I agree completely. Our foundation's been working on tools at a different level. He's talking about system tools, which we desperately need. But I'm still in the trenches, and I need tools I can use every day in my practice. I need to be able to have the conversation with the patient about what matters to them and what are the underlying personal drivers for them. So we've created a whole set of tools, tested them, published them, called Healing-Oriented Practices and Environment Tools. One of those is the personal health inventory we adapted from the Veterans Administration. And I teach my residents and students and other physicians and other clinicians to have a hope visit. Give them the personal health inventory and have that discussion, and then help facilitate their ability to improve their health. Salutogenesis in those areas. So we need practice tools, day-to-day, boots on the ground, and system tools to measure the impact of that.
Well, we're ending on a much more optimistic note than I think where we began, which is great, right? And that's the point of this summit, right? And this has been an amazing discussion. Is there anything else I should have asked you? Anything we missed?
You know,
any points you wanted to make, Dr.
Jones? You know, I think there is a big elephant. Okay. And it is the profit that is being made off of not doing this. There are huge industries that are just following the rules, right? Okay. That are making a large amount of money off of suffering. We can't take that money away because people need some of that, but we need to now reinvest it so we don't need as much of it. And we're going to get a lot of pushback. The policymakers already get a lot of pushback saying, no, you can't change this because it'll actually cut into the bottom line of the corporate structure. And here is something we're going to have to face head on and say, you know, does this produce value? Does the health and wealth interchange, is it actually being optimized? Or is the health producing a lot of wealth, but that wealth isn't going back to improve the community well-being?
Final thought?
Yeah, I'll just say this. You know, I spoke a moment ago about this kind of software tool we've been working on. And I think one thing we didn't spend as much time on was really this idea of the role of emerging technology in this space and its potential influence. You know, Heather, when I think about this, again, this issue of clinician well-being being at the root of kind of where healthcare is headed, a few things stand out to me. You know, one is, you know, going forward, we know that there will be increasing demand on healthcare, right? We have an aging population. And as of now, we have falling supply, right? So our healthcare workforce is also aging, right? And we are losing our workforce, as Dr. Jonas mentioned a bit ago. We know that costs are rising as well, right? As we mentioned a bit ago. We also know that there's this unknown factor of emerging tech, right? Generative AI and the role that it will play in the future of healthcare. And I think, you know, you look at the AAMC report, which said that in the next 10 years, we could have up to 100,000 physician shortage. Part of what something I think is very important for me that I've been wanting to advocate for is to kind of raise awareness to the fact that as that physician shortage increases, the nature of healthcare will change. It will be increasingly harder for you to see a physician, right, in the community and elsewhere. And as the rise of technology increases, right, that will only accelerate that trend. And so I think these are very timely issues. I think this is a public policy, a public health issue, and I'm hoping we can do something about it.
Well, thank you both. This has been a wonderful discussion, and good luck with the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Princeton Pulse podcast, a production of Princeton University's Center for Health and Well-Being. The show was hosted by me, Professor Heather Howard, produced by Amy Bronfield, and edited by Alex Brownstein. We invite you to subscribe to the Princeton Pulse podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy your podcasts.